Coming up this week on The Right Side, an official admission from the Trudeau government that electoral reform is off the table. Alberta is contemplating accepting more refugees, and a win for the Site C Dam in BC. Plus, a rundown of the media coverage following the Quebec City mosque shooting. This is The Right Side, Episode 2, recorded Saturday, February 4th, 2017. Rejection, Refugees, and Reform. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of The Right Side. Shane and Patrick here once again with The Right Side. Welcome back.
Good to be back, as always.
Yeah, it's so fun to sit down and have these chats about the news and what's been going on and provide this different side of the story to everyone. And if you guys are just joining us for the first time, you might be wondering what The Right Side is. Well, The Right Side is a podcast that attempts to cut through all of the sensationalism and bias that you find in the day-to-day news media, whether it be, you know, from a established news source such as your local newspaper or an online startup news company specializing in either the left or the right side of the news. Well, the left or right side of political of the news, because we are obviously providing the right side of the news. But more on that later, I think. I think we have a good segment planned that illustrates what we mean by that. But yeah,
and we'll be able to talk about that later, of course.
Exactly. So, as we usually begin The Right Side, we start off with our right news rundown for the week. This week, we are going to be focusing on one story from Canada, and one from Alberta, and one from BC that are all relevant to the day's news that we have been witnessing in our country. So first up is a story stating that Trudeau abandons electoral reform, breaking a key campaign promise. You guys will probably remember that in the 2015 campaign, the Liberal Party famously or infamously, depending on how you look at things, promised that that election would be the last election fought under the first-past-the-post system, which is our current system right now here in Canada. So the words uttered by the Democratic Reform Minister state that the broad support needed among Canadians for a change of this magnitude does not exist, and a new clear preference for a new electoral system, let alone a consensus, has not emerged. And this was Democratic Institutions Minister Katrina Gold when she first chatted with the media and shared some insight on what her ministry mandate letter stated.
Yeah, and she's been under fire in the House of Commons during the question periods over the past week or so on this issue, just because the Trudeau government hasn't promised what they said they would. And it wasn't even just we're going to look at other electoral reforms and we're going to do some polling and see what Canadians want. It was clearly 2015 is the last election that will be fought under first-past-the-post. We're going to change it.
That's a very bold proclamation to make, considering that in other countries, the UK, I know you guys did it in BC, when you attempted to change electoral systems, there was a referendum. And to make that proclamation was very bold and worried people about the state of democracy. But, you know, we're of the opinion here that the government has made the right choice in this decision, since based on their preferences, we would not have likely seen a referendum in making that decision. And as I stated, it's long established that whenever a voting system is going to be changed, you ask the people on something that is so very important. I know UK and BC, I'm not sure if there's any other countries that have attempted to do that recently. I know New Zealand did it in the 1990s, and they were successful changing from first past the post to proportional. So it has been known to take that form, especially in the Westminster democracy system, when people start thinking about whether the electoral system should be changed.
Mm-hmm. And I think when you do change electoral systems, I think the government does have a duty to consult with the people. Not just consult, but have a clear-cut referendum on it with one defined question.
Yes, exactly. And, I mean, it wasn't even clear as to what the options for this would have been based on the survey that we talked about last week. The funny mydemocracy.ca survey that so many people found issues with back in December. We covered that on episode one. You can find that at rightsidenews.ca in the archives. But it would have also made a huge mistake, would have been a huge mistake had they gone through with this, because it was long documented that the preference of the Liberal Party, the party in power, was of course the preferential ballot, which obviously, being a centrist party, is going to benefit them most of the time, I think, unless we're a little bit concerned or unsure of who the second preference of most people would be when they vote.
Well, yeah, exactly, because Green supporters, NDP supporters will all choose the Liberals as their second choice. Even the Bloc probably would choose the Liberals as their second choice, whereas none of the other parties would be the second choice of any other party.
Exactly. And the other options, of course, proportional representation, which was favored by the Greens and the NDP, that doesn't favor any one large political party. And, you know, if you look at this compared to the results of the MyDemocracy.ca survey, it shows that Canadians want a government that is indeed accountable and easy to understand, and they know who is making the calls. 67% of the Canadians are somewhat or very satisfied with the way democracy is working. And along with that, they want it to be easy to understand, and they want to know what the result of the ballot will be when they check that little box. So this decision ultimately jives with what that survey says, which we found very interesting and went into huge depth last week. And it was interesting that a week after we discussed that, the actual results and the stance from the government came out that, oh, we're not going to actually be changing anything here. So, and I think that ultimately shows that a good majority of people here feel that change either isn't needed or wanted at this time. So
I also think it's quite interesting to note that the government is rather than doing actual polling and actual referendums, they're doing their own surveys with their own biased questions to figure out information about what people want. Because when you ask people, do you want your government to be held accountable? Do you want it to be easy to understand? They're going to say, of course we do. So the government takes this to mean, oh, well, they must want first past the post, because that's really easy to be accountable, and it's really easy to understand as well. The winner takes all.
Right.
So I think what they're doing with this is they're asking the loaded questions, and then they're basing their policy decisions based on skewed answers, which is actually quite worrying when you think about it.
Indeed.
They're not clearly asking Canadians what they want. They're going about it in a roundabout way to get the answers they want to have.
Exactly. And how many people, aside from us and, you know, the few in the mainstream media that are talking about this week, are actually truly concerned about the idea of electoral reform?
Probably not that many, because we talked about it a bit in my classes at school, and I talked about it with some friends, and they're like, oh, was this really a big deal? I didn't really think it was, but all of the traditional media out there is making it out as if it's a really big deal. I think there were headlines screaming that Trudeau is a liar and whatnot. And
right.
While that may be the case, is it truly that big of a deal in society today until something actually happens with it?
And, you know, that ultimately underscores everything that you can talk about, that when decisions are made, is that sometimes decisions that are campaigned on and in a platform get thrown out the window. And more often than not, they will be seen as liars. And it was just really odd to see that much coverage of someone being called a liar for something like this. It's almost as though some media outlets were feeling that this was actually a much larger issue than it actually was. And, you know, you look at the way it was reported, and it definitely felt as though they were saying that there are people that are upset with this decision and feel that change is actually needed. Yes, I'm sure there are people out there who feel that way, but it's not going to be a huge majority of people and that will be enough to warrant change. So that was a very interesting perspective to see in the media on this. And I think what they definitely glossed over was the fact that if you were to ask people and perhaps even poll it professionally, you would find that probably less than 20%, maybe even a single digit percentage of people would actually be concerned about this issue.
Yeah, it was really funny when I was reading news articles about this, and they were saying how there's talk of outrage and about the decision, and all you could find that people that were outraged were NDP MPs and Elizabeth May. I think she said it was I've never been more betrayed in my adult life by a government before. And I thought, wow, I'm sure she's been betrayed more in her adult life, considering she only has one seat in the House of Commons for her party.
And I'm not sure about their prospects going forward, but
yeah,
it is what it is. Anyways, this was reported through the Globe and Mail, this story. So they covered it adequately, but there were, of course, other media outlets that just didn't cover it in such a way that was true and ultimately covering what the facts are based on the MyDemocracy.ca survey and the general sentiment of Canadians.
Yeah, and I think unless you were living under a rock or living outside of Canada, you probably would have heard this at some point if you picked up any media source, because they were pushing it all week, basically.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
All right, well, shall we move on to story number two?
I believe so.
This one coming out of Alberta states that Alberta would accept more refugees if Ottawa lifts the cap, said Premier Notley this week. And I quote, "What certainly we indicated to them at the time is that we'd be very happy to work with them to increase the number if that's the direction they should go." This was said by her in a news conference on Wednesday. Also, according to government sources in the province, Alberta received 7,004 refugees between November 1st, 2015 and December 31st, 2016, and of that amount, 4,921 were Syrian. Meanwhile, the Calgary Catholic Immigration Society, CCIS, estimates that 3,400 of these refugees landed in Calgary last year. So more refugees could be on the way to Alberta if the federal government ultimately decides to take more in. Now, on the surface, you might think, oh, we're just going to be increasing the number. But what this appears to be is a reaction to the immigration and refugee ban that has been in place in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And Trudeau went on record last week to state that he'd be willing to take more numbers if the United States wasn't going to.
Right. And I mean, it's not as though we haven't been doing our job. Since the whole refugee process started, there's been 39,000 Syrian refugees that have been processed into Canada. So we are bringing a lot of them in. And I think the idea behind this from the government and perhaps the focus in the mainstream media is to show that, okay, we are going to be the counterbalance force to the U.S. presidency and the U.S. administration and pick up the slack where they're not doing that anymore. And I think there's some ethical questions that can be asked about that. Should a state such as Canada be interfering in such a way with the American policy? That's an interesting idea for debate. And if the roles were reversed, how would the Canadian government feel if the U.S. was trying to compensate for something that we were or were not doing?
Mm-hmm. Such as oil or pipelines.
Exactly.
Or softwood lumber or fishing.
Right. And I mean, it's not as though that we don't accept these refugees. We do accept them. And I think before we open the doors to more of them, there definitely needs to be some discussion on our side of the border about what we're doing to help them integrate, because I think there was a report that came out a few months ago that said some of them are having troubles learning English and getting established in their communities a year after the fact. And I believe it's actually a year after they arrive that they start to lose government support. So if that's not happening a year after the fact, that program needs to be looked at and ultimately perhaps adjusted to allow them to adapt better before the doors are open toward to more.
Yeah, and I think rather than even just the ethical questions that you can ask about it, there's also economical questions that you can ask about it. I mean, it's no secret that Alberta is going through tough economic times
right now. Oh, yeah, most
right
definitely.
Now. And an extra even 1,000 people can cost millions upon millions of dollars in resettlement and flights and housing and food.
And the job market as well.
Yeah, and things and education and all those different
right, and education, that's a perfect example. Here in Alberta, there is a school shortage, and I do imagine that the core of these people coming over are family-aged people with children that will need schools. So It's an infrastructure question for us as well. So ultimately, it comes down to the ethical question is, should we be really attempting to overcompensate for actions that are being done in the U.S. when we might not actually have the infrastructure to handle what we have right now? And that, I believe, is what was missed in this story. And when it was covered also on the nightly news, is that there was no talk about the existing refugees or whether or not there is the infrastructure capability here to handle that.
And I think this came up like over a year ago when the federal Liberals first got into power, and they made their big promises of the big numbers of the refugees that they were going to bring in, and they didn't even come close to the numbers that they were promising to because of the infrastructure problems.
Right. So this is just an example here of a story that was in the news but wasn't covered fully to the extent that it should have been. Specifically with regards to infrastructure, economics, and integration, which anytime you're bringing new people in, you got to make sure that's happening, because if not, they're not going to be happy here. So This story was initially from the Calgary Herald, but of course appeared in many other news outlets as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What do you got for BC?
For BC, I've got a article that I found. It's called Site C Dam Win for Hydro as a Native Veto Rejected by BC Court of Appeal. So basically, this is the BC Court of Appeal striking down any notion of a so-called native veto on the controversial Site C Dam. And for people who don't know, the Site C Dam is a project by BC Hydro, which is our provincial hydroelectric company that provides power and water utilities to almost pretty much every building in our province. So this is a large-scale earth-fill hydroelectric dam on the Peace River in northeastern Alberta, which is close to the border with Alberta. The site is actually downstream from the existing WAC Bennett and the Peace Canyon dams, so it's not like the river isn't dammed already. And basically what the justices found was that, quote, the duty to consult and accommodate, which is enshrined in Canadian law, by the way, does not afford First Nations a veto over the proposed activity. This was Justice Peter Lowry wrote with the support of his colleagues Peter Wilcock and John Savage. And basically, the duty to consult means that the project managers have to collaborate and find a balance of compromise with First Nations bands that are in the treaty area of under Treaty 8, I believe it is, that covers most of northern Alberta and BC and Saskatchewan.
That's right.
But they don't have to compromise when the only compromise means that they have to abandon the project completely, which is what the First Nations groups have been pushing for. They've been trying to stall it for as long as they can and to try and get it canceled. So Lowry explained that over the course of 7 years, BC Hydro has met with them 177 times and funded their full participation in the environmental assessment and consultation processes throughout, in accordance with several agreements made with them over that time. And the judge found that the lengthy consultation process had been conducted in good faith and was extensive both qualitatively and quantitatively. And BC Hydro also gave the native groups more than $5.8 million to fund their own participation in the review. And there was also federal and provincial government money granted to them as well. So this has been something that's been going on for ages. The provincial Liberal government has been trying to push for the Site C dam to reduce our dependence on interprovincial energy, and to also make it so that our own hydro payments are a lot less. And anyone who's lived in BC over the last 5 years will have noticed that their hydro bills have gone way up from what they used to be. And this is because just the cost of hydro is going up because there's no new projects, but also because we're having to depend on the United States and Alberta and a lot of the hydroelectric dams from Quebec.
This underscores a few very key points, I think, that can apply to the entire country. And the first one is that energy independence and the idea of energy that's made here and flows freely between provinces and to the U.S. to a lesser degree, that's still important, is key towards not only decreasing costs for homeowners, but also for ensuring that we're not going to be at the mercy of someone else. Because like you said, you guys are importing energy from the U.S. and from Alberta, and that's caused prices to go up. And if you control your own source of energy, that ultimately means that that's creating jobs there, and it creates a level of freedom in the market for everyone. So that's really great.
And it creates economic prosperity as well.
Right. And one thing leads to another. And as we said in our pilot, if you don't have a good investing climate, there won't be the investors. That won't spur the economy, and that won't spread prosperity around. So That's why that's good. And, you know, I think so many times we also see this threat of a quote-unquote native veto everywhere, that the fact it's been struck down in BC, and, you know, it might go to the Supreme Court, as the article says, but if it were to do that and were to get struck down there, I think that would also be great for energy projects in Alberta and across the country as well, because we have these same kind of issues here where native groups and other groups in general attempt to stop them, but little do they realize the protesters who in some cases are just brought in from out of nowhere or might not even be from the region, don't realize that this affects everyone in the immediate area. And if projects like this go ahead, as we stated, it just improves quality of life all around. And all you have to do is look at the numbers.
Exactly. And this is an article I found in the Vancouver Sun, which is one of the two daily papers owned by Post Media that serve the Vancouver region, but are widely found in many other places around the province as well. And I'm pretty sure it's been covered in other areas as well, but I didn't find it in too many other places other than Vancouver. So
yeah, we didn't hear much about this here. So.
Yeah. But I think it's something that will impact a lot of people if
it
does go through.
All right. You ready for the firing line?
I am ready to fire up the firing line.
And this is, of course, the segment of the show in which we talk about a story that has been reported somewhat inaccurately and could have been reported in perhaps a different light. And that story is, of course, the Quebec City mosque shooting, and in particular the fallout from that and what we know and what we don't know almost a week after the attack. So what we initially figured out is that there were 6 dead and many more injured, and funerals have already been taking place for the victims. The suspect who was arrested and charged was 27-year-old Alexandre Bissonnette. Initially, the police reported to the media that there was another suspect, but this was later revealed to be an error by the police. And rather than correcting the error, some media outlets actually just deleted the story about that second suspect, which they should have issued a correction on that. No motive has also yet been unveiled by the RCMP, even though it appears as though the investigation has concluded at the physical site. It was also revealed that the shooter was anti-immigrant and anti-feminist. Then the media decided to take it a step further and felt it was necessary to shine a light on some of the shooter's Facebook likes. Quoting from the story here, his Facebook likes included pages for U.S. President Donald Trump, far-right French politician Marine Le Pen, the federal NDP, former federal NDP leader Jack Layton, chess clubs, video games, and organizations at Laval University. Most of those you would ordinarily think aren't too big of a deal, but the fact they choose to shine a light on it with the first two kind of says something about the media coverage of the story, I think.
Yeah, the fact that they're cherry picking what they have to fit their own narrative is pretty disingenuous when you think about it. They're trying to fit the right ones that they could have. So he might have had many different ones like music and video games, chess clubs. What's so bad about that? or organizations at university. I'm pretty sure when you go to university, you get involved with organizations. It's one of the facts of post-secondary life, basically.
Right.
And I think following and liking politicians' page doesn't mean you actually like them. It just means you want to follow what their news are. I'm pretty sure there's lots of people that follow famous politicians and whatnot. Just
oh yeah, most definitely. And same thing with retweets. You know, you often see the retweet. A retweet is not an endorsement. Well, that's entirely true. But anyways, media coverage following this has rightly focused on the funerals and the vigils held for the victims. That is one thing that they definitely did get right with this. In addition to this, however, there's been a huge focus on a problem that may or may not exist in our society, and that is Islamophobia. And there's no ultimate way to take the pulse of an entire country or a region or a province and determine if it's Islamophobic or xenophobic towards a certain group. There's just no way of doing that. There will always be small pockets of xenophobia or racism in any society. It's wrong, but it unfortunately exists. And I think that this is kind of what the general coverage following the initial aftermath of this was focused on, is that this is indeed a huge problem in our society. And I'm not part of either of those groups, so I can't say for certain if it's felt on a daily basis, but I think in general, people are fairly accommodating.
Yeah, and I think you can make parallels with other shootings that have happened as well, such as I think probably the most famous ones in the Columbine shooting massacre, where they went really in depth on the shooters and discovered their love for German metal band Rammstein. They loved Doom, and they made custom levels for that. So they also loved certain music groups, and they read certain books. So there was a whole bunch of outpouring from the media, and people just hated these groups that these shooters liked, because they akined what he liked or what they liked to someone who was Hitler or something like that. And
yeah,
I know for sure that in this case, they're going to try and pin this on whatever they can just to find a motive. And honestly, I think that's wrong. What they should be doing is focusing on the victims and the good that they have done in society,
exactly,
rather than focusing on the shooters themselves.
Right. And you know, there's a far more sinister thing that they could be doing. It could just be for ratings and clicks.
Hmm.
And, you know, as a result of this whole episode, it's felt as though the media has taken on the role of a social educator in our society. And ultimately, when the media acts in such a manner, they become part of the conversation rather than just relaying the info and facts and allowing the watchers, readers, and viewers to decide how they feel on a certain matter, which isn't what classic news media was for.
Mm-hmm. And I think they try and do this through like editorials and opinion pieces and whatnot. And these show up everywhere and they're heavily
promoted. Oh, yeah, most definitely.
And they say, well, it's just an opinion. It doesn't matter. But they don't realize that people take it as fact because they're media. But
yeah.
I think what.
And it also appears as a result of the producers in the nightly newscasts, unfortunately, as well. So this story was initially from Global News. and it was covered much the same way in all the other sources out there. So definitely needed some clarity on this from the mainstream media. Yeah. They covered the first part right, but beyond that, it kind of just went off the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
All right, there's our news for the week. We're just about to wrap up this episode of The Right Side, but I do believe you have a word of the week for us.
I do, and our word of the week this week is going to be right, as in the word right, as in Right Side News. So if you go onto the dictionary for right, it's going to tell you that there is a lot of different definitions, but I'd like to think that we here at The Right Side espouse most of them. And first one is righteous and upright. I think we are very righteous in our views and how we feel. I think we are being in accordance with what is just, good, or proper, which is the right conduct. I think we try and be very professional and give everyone and our listeners the right information. It could be conforming to facts or truth, as in the right answer. I think we're trying to conform to facts and truth, and we're trying to root out the bias, sensationalism that you can see out there.
Root out the fake news.
Exactly. Suitable and appropriate, straight, as in a right line. We will always give it to you straight whenever we feel a certain way, as in genuine and real. I think we're also genuine and real. And there's also a bunch of other ones, such as acting or judging in accordance with truth or fact, being in good physical or mental health or order.
We'll definitely help you be that on the show.
we'll definitely improve your mental health. We'll make you think. most favorable or desired, socially acceptable, or often capitalized as of, adhering to, or constituted by the right, especially in politics. So I think when it comes down to it, we are the definition of right here at The Right Side.
And, you know, going back to the pilot episode, that's why the name for this show just made so much sense. And we hope to abide by these and continue to conform to them on each episode that we bring. So, word of the week, right? Last week's word of the week was news. Combine those two together, and you have this podcast.
Exactly.
All right, well, that's it for this episode of The Right Side. If you want to find us, you can find us at our website, rightsidenews.ca. If you want to subscribe on iTunes, there's a quick shortcut to that, rightsidenews.ca/iTunes. Also on Twitter and Facebook at RightsideCA. With that being said, thank you for sharing your time with us, everyone, and we will see you next week for another episode of The Right Side.
We will see you next week, and have a good week.